From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's still hot, to be sure, but if you look close, you'll see the signs the season is about to change. The leaves in the mountains are turning. Or have a look at a garden. It's that time of the year when there's such abundance, sweet corn and melons and squash. But this is also the time to start thinking about preserving all this stuff. My mom will be canning tomatoes soon, and grape juice if she can beat the raccoons to the Concords. The farmer David Mas Masumoto wrote a book several years ago where he described this time of the year, the aroma of ripening fruit and the anticipation of autumn where the pressures of the harvest are over. Today in the program, we're offering an homage to some of the crops of summer, and we're hoping to hear from you about the best peach you ever tasted or your own memories about the simple joy of growing your own food. It's a show about the last days of summer, after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's been nearly 20 years since I drove down to 800 North in Orem, Utah to talk to Vern Stratton. I was producing a story about peaches, and I had been told Vern was the expert. So we met at his fruit stand. It was near the end of the season. He moved past the apples and the tomatoes, the sweet corn, took off a weathered straw cowboy hat and bent over a box of peaches, squinting. He was looking for a sweet one.
We have Elegant Lady, Lemon Alberta, Redskin Alberta, and the Angelus. And you pick one that's got the red color with the yellow ground color. This yellow ground cover gives them away. It means there's lots of sugar in there.
Vern brings out a pocket knife and cuts into the fruit. He carves a circle around the center and tugs it free from the pit. And then he bites into it. And he smiles, delighted with his discovery.
It's my favorite fruit.
In his book, Epitaph for a Peach, the writer David Mas Masumoto describes this discovery. He writes about washing the fruit under a stream of cooling water, how your fingertips search for the gushy side, and then he describes biting into it, how the juice trickles down your cheeks and dangles down your chin. Mas Masumoto calls it a real bite, a primal act, a sensory celebration. This was back in 1995 when I talked to David by phone from his family farm in the San Joaquin Valley. He's a third-generation Japanese farmer who grows grapes and peaches. And the book he wrote was his attempt at trying to save the Suncrest peach. It's a variety that is full of flavor, but it's fragile. Supermarket buyers aren't interested in the peach because it has a short shelf life and it isn't a vibrant red. Really, his book is as much about his struggle to save the family farm as the peach. And he describes both of their futures as fragile.
It's real scary because that older generation that still has that direct memory of the farm, and I could often tell that they're the ones that really know what a good peach tastes like. The younger generation, they're not going to have that affinity, that understanding, that connection with the land.
In Orem, Utah, 800 North stretches from the freeway to the mouth of Provo Canyon, and it wasn't all that long ago that the road was lined with nothing but orchards, acres and acres of apples and cherries and peaches. The families that owned these orchards sold their fruit along the road at small stands built of 2x4s and corrugated metal. And when I talked to Vern Stratton, he mentioned the names, the Crandalls and the Fergusons and the Finches, the Sorensons, more than a dozen families. But his is the only family farm left now. Most of the property's been sold for subdivisions and businesses. And when we spoke with him, he wasn't sure if his sons, a fifth generation of Strattons to work the Orem orchards, would continue to farm.
It's just like anything else. It becomes part of your character and your makeup. And it's a peaceful way of life. It teaches you many of the good things of life that you can't learn anywhere else. Hardship, success and failure. The great dynasty of the Lord and his workings with nature. It teaches you all those things that out being in it year after year and day after day, that's the only way you learn it. There's no other way. You can't read it in a book and understand it. You have to be out and be among it daily and into it and part of you, then you begin to feel it.
I I had begun the year hoping most of us could distinguish the difference between a green peach and a ripe one with real flavor, the kind that triggers memories of savory juices dripping down chins and nectar with the aroma of nature's bounty. I had faith in the power of family stories to convey the meaning of a summer peach. For one final moment in our evolution as a nation, we still have a community memory of the family farm. I still carry the personal baggage from our rural past, a history of family members who sustained the land, and the legacy of a community that worked the earth for generations. But this is the final generation holding an affinity with the American family farm. This is the generation that will control the destiny of not only my Suncrest peaches, but also my way of life.
Today in the program, we're talking about the food of the summer season, peaches and sweet corn and tomatoes. And we're hoping you can offer that we can offer some practical advice today, how you pick a peach or select the perfect melon. The conversation, though, is also about the traditions that come with the season and how you preserve them. We invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is our number, 801-585-9378, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Do you have traditions in your family for summer crops? Is there a particular fruit or vegetable or maybe even a particular dish that you look forward to during the height of the summer harvest? And maybe it's a bite of sweet corn or the sight of a packed tomato plant that brings up the memory of a particular time and place in your past. If so, we want to hear from you. We want to hear from memories and connections to summer's iconic crops. Again, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us now on the program is David Masumoto. He's an organic peach and grape farmer, as we said, the author of four books, including the one we had him read there, Epitaph for a Peach. He's joining us today by phone from his family farm in Delray, California. And Masumoto, welcome. Thanks very much for being back with us.
Oh, thank you very much. It's good to hear your voice again.
Yeah, you too. You sound none the worse for wear.
Oh, things are going well. I'm still farming and growing peaches.
Good. Well, I wanted to. It's been 17 years since you wrote the book and we last spoke. Give us a sense of what has changed and maybe what's still the same.
I think what's same is the same resonance that Vern talked about, that love of the land and the joy in eating a peach that you grew yourself and understanding rich flavors that take you into memories of your past. All that has remained the same. It's part of the authenticity, I think, that we try to do here on our farm. What's changed is the world around us in both great ways and not so great ways. Great ways is, I think, from 17 years ago, the food world has drastically changed. You have, stores like Whole Foods that have exploded on the scene and brought a whole different type of a food to people. There's been an elevation in how food is treated and incorporated family and life back into food. All that is good. And that simultaneously, you've had also the economics of food production and the challenges of trying to make a living doing what we do here on the farm.
I wonder, do you still worry? You were really worried about it when we last spoke, about the extinction of the family farmer, and you really wondered about that next generation. Do you still worry as much?
Oh, absolutely. I worry even a little more because our daughter is taking over the farm, so we're starting to partner together. So not only am I not, I'm just not only worried about my, how many more harvests I have left on this earth, but now I'm thinking about another generation and what have I gotten her into?
So how did you do it? How did you manage? Was it just something that she had the experience? Did you encourage her, or was it just something that happened?
Well, one, we never separated the work that we do from our family life. When you have a family farm, you don't go off to the office in some amorphous place and come back at the end of the day. So she witnessed everything that we did on the farm, both the struggles and the challenges, but also the joy and the personal connection that we had. So she witnessed that growing up. I think the best thing we did was very similar to my father. He let me run off to college. So she ran off to college and ran off to, she went to Berkeley for her undergraduate degree and then went to the University of Texas in Austin for a graduate degree, and then decided that she wants to circle back and come home. So I think by allowing her the freedom to leave also gave her the opportunity to come home. So that's sort of the journey that she took.
You've talked to us about how these days you're really focused inward. In some ways, you've kind of gotten more intense. And I wanted to know what that meant.
Oh, I think it's trying to incorporate the work that we do on this very personal daily level, but understand at the same time, it all goes public. In a way, all farmers live in the public arena because we don't hoard our food. We grow it and it goes out to the public. But even today, with the advent of new social media, new levels of communication, farming is much more open and transparent than it's ever been. And I think that's good, because it allows more people to be part of the work that we do. So in a sense, I've gone public, but yet it's all still very internal, because it's not as if I am a publicly traded operation and I have, you know, stockholder meetings. Our stockholder meetings take place at the dinner table that someone buys our fruit, or in the kitchen when they're preserving something, peaches for the winter. That's our stockholder meeting.
Well, you were raised growing peaches, of course, so it's not necessarily something that you yourself picked, but you have described that fruit as being part of your DNA.
Oh, absolutely. I think when you grow up on a family farm and are intimately involved, you can't help but understand those rhythms that are involved with nature, you know, the understanding the different dynamics of the seasons and what does it mean, and also looking at nature as a resource. It's part of what we get our livelihood from, and how nature itself is uncontrollable. It has its own rhythm, and as clearly as this year is seen when you start reading stories about the drought across America, or even today's story of the hurricane striking the South Gulf area.
So, Mas, what is a peach supposed to taste like? I mean, can you describe what it's supposed to taste like?
Vern did a very good job in your opening on that. I think a peach has to taste like something that has meaning and will build memory, meaning that a peach is going to be sweet, and it's going to have, at least our peaches, because we grow yellow flesh peaches, there's going to be a little acidity in it. So it's not sweet like candy, nor do I want it to be sweet like candy. It would have a sweetness about it, but yet balanced with this kind of acidity that gives a little aftertaste, and it stays with you. A peach should remind you of something pleasant. Hopefully it reminds you of home. Hopefully it reminds you of a time you ate a wonderful peach communally. I like to think that most rarely do we eat by ourselves. Most of us eat in the company of others, and that's part of a great meal, a great flavor, is that incorporation of all those things fused into one. To me, a great peach embodies all those different elements in it.
Well, we should mention to people, because it was one of the crucial questions back in 1995, you know, the future of the Suncrest peach. I guess for now, anyway, the peach has made it.
Yeah, I think finally after, 30 years, I've grown comfortable that I'm going to actually get a crop. I mean, every year when spring comes, I'm basically thinking, what have I done to screw up the crop? But amazingly, my mistakes are overcome, and we have blossoms, and the blossoms turn into small little fruit that eventually grow into peaches. So I'm finally, after 30 years, confident that, okay, we'll get some kind of crop. So that angst is over. Also, because of the dynamics changing in the marketplace, where the organic marketplace has certainly grown, the specialty produce market has evolved. So there are people wanting and looking to buy our type of fruit, like many, I think, wonderful farmers do, and certainly everything from the buy local movement to the organic movement to the sustainable movement have all contributed to a type of stability so that I'm not worried so much about the pure survival. It's more of a question of how do I want to keep growing these things and how do they fit in the broader community. So, yeah, there is stability. And also, as our daughter comes to the farm, too, how is that going to evolve and change within her lifetime, too?
Mas Masumoto, he's a writer and an organic peach farmer in California's Central Valley, and he joined us this morning. Mas, thanks very much for the time. Good luck to you.
Oh, thank you.
801-585-WEST, again, the number to join the conversation. We'll get to some of your calls in just a moment here, but let me bring another voice into the conversation. We have with us Stephen Rosenberg. He's the owner of Liberty Heights Fresh Market here in Salt Lake City. He's also he calls himself the chief eating officer of the market. It's a specialty food store in Salt Lake. And Stephen, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Good to be here, Doug.
Well, it's interesting. What do you think when you listen to Mas Masumoto? I mean, it seems like in some ways this is kind of your story too.
Well, you know, I was raised on a farm where we in the 60s had a couple of pretty good sized peach orchards. And we grew varieties that were yellow, and we grew varieties that had flavor. And we've sort of gone full circle. I think we're back to a tremendous desire by people who eat with passion and sensuality that people want more than just something pretty. They want a taste and a texture that is going to connect them with those memories.
You know, he said in the recording that from 1995, he talked about how an older generation has a sense of what a peach is supposed to taste like. And you were kind of nodding your head because that seemed to resonate with you.
Well, it resonates because, most people buy their food at a supermarket or a large box, big box store. And that is not the greatest place to buy fresh fruits and vegetables, especially at this time of year. I mean, there's just many wonderful farmers markets where you can get things that are picked that morning or the evening before, and you can connect with with our version of Mas Masumoto and meet the grower and connect so much more deeply with a personality and a place.
You know, when he writes about the Suncrest peach, for example, something that was at least in those days, it was hard to market because it was fragile. People didn't know what it was supposed to look like. It didn't have a particular look to it. This is something you've talked a lot about. You've talked about the fact that there are green peaches that are incredibly sweet. I mean, like, we don't have the right impression of a peach sometimes.
Well, supermarket buyers in the 50s and 60s and 70s began to really shift to wanting a hard fruit that would hold up on the shelf that was red, because red was an exciting color next to yellow. Mm. And it wasn't about the flavor or the texture. It wasn't about the experience eating. It was about moving those boxes of fruit into the store and out of the store with shoppers. And I think what's terribly unfortunate in the last generation or two, Doug, is that there are so many that perhaps didn't enjoy eating a peach because they didn't know what a really wonderful peach, like David and Vern describe, tasted like.
How do you describe what a peach is supposed to taste like?
Oh, my. For me?
Yeah.
It's an emotional experience. It really is, because it takes me back to the orchard when I was a kid, where you would just be dripping in peach juice. I mean, you'd leave in the morning and your mother would say, don't eat too many peaches, you're going to get a stomachache. And sure enough, you'd come home and, I mean, if one falls on the ground while you're picking another, well, that one obviously wanted to be picked too. So you go down and you pick it up and you dust it off and you eat it. And there's nothing more wonderful than eating a peach that is warm from the sun and has flavors and David so well described the complexity between a sweetness that isn't sugary sweet.
Yeah.
It's
more complicated, right?
It's far more complicated, but that acid I think it's one of the things that attracts me more to a yellow peach than a white peach. A white peach has no acid, and it's a much less complex experience eating. It's still interesting, but it doesn't connect me to the tree, to the work that farmers put into growing great peaches, and to hopefully a season that will allow for safe pollination away from frost and, not too many pests and lots of warm days. And, I was down at the barn in Provo yesterday picking up peaches and visiting with the grower, and that's just precious.
Mm. Well, let's stay with us. Let's take a call. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Let's go to Rosie. Rosie's in Provo, too. Hi, Rosie.
Hi, Doug. I'm just calling because all the flavors and all the scents of the fruit were important to me when I left the academic life of my parents and parents-in-law in the 70s. My husband and I bought a home in Spring City out where you could look across the fields and see more space that we craved. And we had all the, the background of the wine growers that were sent to Santa Clara by Brigham Young and my Swedish ancestors that grew Russian Astrakhan apples and as they came to Utah. But we wanted to give our children, as our daughters grew up, lots of experiences with the old ways of doing things and eating the real thing. And we sought out opportunities, like we'd go haying with people on the old equipment, or we would go. One event that came to mind when I heard you come on this morning is picking up the red potatoes out of the dirt in Spring City, just where 89, in between Mount Pleasant and Ephraim on Highway 89, is the Strait family farm, and we'd go out there and ride on the old machinery with the Strait's grandkids, who were our children's friends, and watch as the machine would dig up the red potatoes, and we'd jump off and grab them out of the dirt and throw them in the bags. And it was a big community kind of experience, a fun family experience. And then the potatoes tasted totally different than anything we were used to.
Yeah. So. Rosie, thanks.
Yeah.
Glad to hear from you. 801-585-WEST, again, the number to join us. We have John with us. He's a trucker somewhere in Connecticut, I guess, John?
Yeah, I'm rolling through eastern Connecticut. I was born and raised in southern Connecticut, and I now live in Asheville, North Carolina. And I was just listening to your conversation with the peach grower reminded me of just is great about the earth and about living close to the earth, which I never really have growing up in suburban New York City. But I was up in Massachusetts this morning. I stopped by a local farm. I picked out 4 ears of corn, chucked it, and asked them to put it in the microwave. And I had the most delicious, locally grown and picked corn breakfast that I've had probably in 25 years.
That
it reminded me of being 5 years old again.
Yeah.
Mom, we're stopping by the farm near where we lived, and just getting corn picked that morning and throw it in the pot and eating it fresh without any butter or salt. It was the most healthful thing you could have. And I'd love to taste some of those Suncrest peaches. I don't know if I've ever had one before. And I don't know, being on the East Coast, whether they ship that far from where they're grown. But if there is an opportunity that has come from the decay of places like Detroit, where there's now a whole lot of open land, if there's an opportunity, it's that maybe with urban gardening, many, many, many more people will be, close to homegrown and fresh, farm-fresh foods than we've ever had in 200 years.
Yeah,
That's all I can say. That maybe there's an opportunity here to build on top of the decay of some of our dearly departed industries, especially in the Rust Belt.
Yeah, Well, John, thanks. Be careful.
Thank you very much, then. Thank you. Bye.
Stephen, you've talked about that, the opportunities that an economy sort of offers to the way we look at food. And food as sustenance as opposed to food as a luxury, you know.
Well, and it's something that, again, you know, in the late 20th, early 21st century, we've been so disconnected from where food really comes from. And we're getting back to that. I'm not sure we're getting back to that for the best reasons economically, but I think it's a beautiful thing that we're getting back to that.
Because food is essential.
Food is essential. We can live without – well, we might not be able to live without Radio West, but we can live without radio.
We can live without radio.
And, you know, we can live without health care if we take care of ourselves. But we can't live without food. Food is sustenance. Food is something that we must all partake of. And it's if we stop and think about what and how we eat, it is – it's a sensual act that is so deeply fulfilling in a for me growing up on the farm, it's a spiritual thing.
John, thanks again for the call. Stephen Rosenberg is with us, the owner and chief eating officer of Liberty Heights Fresh here in Salt Lake City. We'll get to more of your calls when we get back from a break. 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the fruits of summer, not just fruits, though, of course, the crops of the season, peaches and sweet corn and tomatoes. And we're hoping to hear from you. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Here's an email from Dan who writes, "Growing and preserving food is an important part of Utah's culture. Everyone has a story about family members working together to put up food. And I've heard old men speak tearfully in church about resolving the enmity of 40 years as they worked in the top of a cherry tree on the welfare farm." 801-585-WEST. Again, the number to join us. Back to the phones. Tanner is with us in Orem, Utah. Tanner, welcome.
Oh, thank you.
Sure.
Yeah, well, I've grown up in Orem my whole life, and, you know, I've always, you know, it's all the orchards here, you know. And I remember, you know, picking the apples at the church welfare farm and all that. And I tell you, when you get, like, an apple, a nice, fresh-grown apple, see, compared to, like, the ones at the supermarket, those red delicious, as they call them, they're not delicious in any sense of the word. It's true, but they're nasty. But we have, compared to, like, where I live, Windsor Elementary, next to Windsor Elementary is Windsor Park, City Park, and there's this apple tree there.
Wow.
That me and my friends every summer would go and get apples, and these were unsprayed apples, nothing, they just grow there. And we would go there and pick these apples, they were green, and they were absolutely wonderful. I think the apple tree is left over from an apple orchard that the sea just left in the park, but they were the best apples I've ever had. The tree is still there, and I still go get there. It's just the juices, the tartness, not too tart, not too sweet, and it also takes skill to find a good apple. Since they're not spray, you gotta look, make sure there's no worms.
Yeah.
But they're just so good compared to what you buy at supermarket. They're just delicious.
We got Stephen Rosenberg nodding again. I mean, this idea of finding a tree. I had trees that we picked when I was a kid that you'd look for them, you know.
You know, occasionally I go up to Rock Hill Creamery in Richmond and make cheese, and Pete and I always go into this little town in Idaho and have lunch, and there's this wild plum tree on the side of the road. And I always make sure I go in September, so I always call him ahead. Are those plum trees – is that plum tree ready yet? Well, I don't know. I haven't checked, but he checks for me. And then I make my pilgrimage to Richmond and visit with Pete and Jennifer.
Yeah.
And
that's great. Tanner, thanks.
801-585-WEST,
again, the number to join us. David is with us in Cedar City. David, welcome.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I would just like to make the comment that I recall when I was growing up, I grew up in Pleasant Grove, Utah, there in Utah County. And I remember my parents were adamant that we had a garden at our in our backyard, and I would say it was about as half the size of our house. And we also had a few fruit trees, apricots and apples and things like that. But one thing that my parents taught us while we were growing up was through the hard work that we had to do to till up the garden and dig the trenches and lay the water line, is that we never wasted our food that came out of our garden. And it's one thing that stayed with me forever. And it's another thing that I've actually carried with me and that I've begun to teach my daughters as well. One of them is, 3 months old. The other is 4 years. But, just the joy in seeing her face light up when a pumpkin turns orange or, when cucumbers are ready on the vine, and how we, take them in the house and wash them, and, we care for them. And they definitely don't go to waste. One thing that I've seen with a lot of people that get their produce strictly from the grocery store is, they'll let it go to waste like it, was not worth anything, never mind the hard work that went into growing it and bringing it to market. So yeah. It's something that stayed with me for a long time and that I hope to carry on with my family.
Well, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
That's great. Appreciate it. 801-585-WEST. Again, the number to join the conversation. Steven Rosenberg is here with us. Let me get another voice involved in the conversation. Amy Goldman is with us. She's a gardener, an artist, a philanthropist, an advocate for seed saving and heirloom fruits and vegetables. She's the author of a number of books, among them The Heirloom Tomato, and she also wrote a book about melons for the passionate grower. She's joining us today from her home in Rhinebeck, New York. And Amy Goldman, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks so much, Doug. I'm delighted to be with you today.
Well, I wanted to get your sense of the, I'm not sure how much of the conversation you've been able to hear so far, but some of the calls, it seems like everyone, when they're talking about this, they relate food to a memory and to family. Is that a theme that you hear all the time?
Oh, definitely. I didn't grow up with, my parents weren't gardeners, but they were really good cooks. And, it's just family rituals, eating dinner around the table, sharing conversations and good times, it all becomes embedded in your memory. And when you're talking about, for example, fragrant, aromatic, heirloom melons or peaches, it just gets fixed in your mind and memory. It's something you never forget. And there's just definitely a hunger for fruits and vegetables that taste sublime.
I wanted to ask you about melons. I'm not sure I want to move away from peaches entirely, Stephen, because you've got some here, and I want to talk about them. But I wanted to ask you about melons because you've written extensively about them. We talked about what a peach is supposed to taste like. What's the kind of – because you've described the essential joy of a melon patch in your book. You write about it kind of like being in a candy store. What's the essential joy? What's a melon? I mean, there's so many different varieties, but what's a melon supposed to taste like?
Well, to me, a melon patch or melons are like, it's like walking into a candy store, but it's more. It's not just about the sweetness. It's better. It's they're, luscious, savory, mouth-filling, juicy. And to me, I live for August with the taste of melons at their peak, oozing honey. It's just incomparable.
You say your first melon love was a melon called the Christmas?
Yes. It's not a melon that has a fragrance, but it's what's called a winter melon because it's larger, later in maturity, and longer in storage, and it's just a beautiful yellow and green speckled melon. Difficult to grow on the East Coast, but I fell in love with it. I found one in my garden ripe. Big surprise to me that I could even do it. And the luscious green flesh is, it has no musk, and this is, it's sweeter than orange flesh melons. And this is something our grandparents knew better than we do. The green flesh melons have, taste sweeter and better.
Hmm.
They're also more delicate in texture as a general rule.
It's amazing the variety. I mean, why is it? I confess this is something that I do. I tend to sort of stick with the conventional melons. I need to be a little bit more experimental, I guess, because there's so many out there, I guess, so many different types.
You know, there's just so much more to the world of melons, particularly heirloom melons, and most of us realize that the cantaloupes in grocery stores across America don't even begin to describe the world of melons. You know, they're apart from the wrinkled, netted, ribbed melons you see everywhere, they're... Mm. Do you know that there are melons with warts, freckles, and stars, some that look like snakes or bananas, others that smell or taste like pineapple, mango, peach, or perfume? These are extraordinary fruits. And the thing about melons, you know, they're easy to grow, and unlike peaches, they gratify instantly, producing luscious fruit in one season. So they're grown as annuals, and it's instant gratification.
But it seems like they're scary to grow. You say it's easy, but that seems daunting to some of us.
Well, melons are native to Africa, so they like a hot, long season. But if I can grow melons and watermelons in my Zone 5 garden in upstate New York, then most people can if they follow a couple of simple tricks and just trying to produce the same kinds of conditions as melons native Africa, like starting them inside about 3 or 4 weeks in advance, transplanting them out onto black plastic mulch, for example, covering them with spun polyester row covers to give them a little oomph, a little extra heat early in the season. And, of course, if you can grow short-season varieties, so much the better. This season, my favorite watermelon is the New Hampshire Midget. It was bred to mature in very short season, and it's early, prolific, delicious, small. Of course, the smaller ones come in earlier than the bigger ones, so you have to be choosy about what you grow, but... I can't, you know,
But go for it, right?
Go for it. Yeah. Experiment. What do you have to lose?
Yeah, yeah.
It's certainly true that melons are more finicky to grow than tomatoes, but it's worth the extra effort.
Yeah. Stay with us. We're going to take another couple of calls here. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Let's go to Diana in Ogden, Utah. Diana, hi.
Hi, Doug. I wanted to say I love this time of the year. I've got tomatoes drying on the dashboard of my car right now. It's a perfect place to dry them in 105 inside. And I just love growing organic gardens. I'm an artist and a gardener, and I sell at the Salt Lake City Farmers Market. I've been down there 10 years, and it's such a wonderful place. I love to be a part of the group, the community, and have the fresh produce from Friday night going right to the home on Saturday. It's a wonderful thing to grow locally. And when gas gets to be, who knows, $20 a gallon, we're all going to have to switch our ways.
Yeah. Well, Diana, thanks.
Thank you.
Good luck. 801-585-WEST, again, the number to join the conversation. Steven Rosenberg, so this idea, farmers markets, I mean, they're growing, they're really exploding, and the appeal is clearly the food itself, but it seems like it's also that kind of, what Diana was getting at, that community connection that you're interacting with people as well.
Well, you know, I think with the advent of Facebook and email, you know, there's a real deep need for people to connect with other people face to face, and the farmers market has become very much a social gathering for a segment of the population who is passionate about their food. And it's really interesting because the demographic really changes from that 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning to 10 o'clock in the morning crowd. As we get closer to 1 o'clock, it's a whole different group of people.
Huh.
And they shop differently. And some of them are there just for an outing,
yeah,
especially the later in the day.
Right, right. Well, let's go back to the phones. Kirk is with us in Orem, Utah. Hi, Kirk.
Hey, Doug, how are you?
I'm
fine. I'm a long-time listener, first-time caller.
Good, welcome.
You just hit on something really personal to me. I work on this 800 North Corridor in Orem. I've been many years up in here. Know Vern Stratton, his brother John, who has since passed away. As a child, I played in their orchards. Huh. I just drove past the Finches. They're still there.
Oh, they are.
They got their peach stand up. Crandall still work their orchards there over on Center Street. You know, it's just a wonderful place. I had a peach this morning off of my peach tree, and to me, a peach is just summer.
Yeah.
It's just, as it ripens, it just absorbs all of the smells and flavors and tastes and everything of summer, and biting into it is just, you know, like summer exploding in your mouth, and the juices dripping down. You know, I've snuck peaches out of orchards. You know, I've worked in orchards picking fruit at one time or another, and it is. It's just a wonderful experience.
Yeah. Well, Kirk, thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Doug.
Glad you called. 801-585-WEST. Again, the number to join us. Joe is with us. I'm supposed to take a break, but Joe, welcome.
Yes, thank you.
Sure.
I'm loving this conversation. It's thrilling. I'm a beekeeper. I live in Ogden. I have bees. I love my honey. There's nothing better than freshly extracted raw honey. But one of the benefits I get from it is my neighbor has a huge garden, and this year it has been prolific because of the bees, and he shares his bounty with us, and I have all this wonderful, wonderful summer squash. And it's more of a question. I'm like the previous caller. I don't want to waste anything, but what can I do with all this wonderful summer squash?
Hmm. Stephen, you want to take that, or we'll have Amy sound off on that as well?
I eat summer squash almost three times a day this time of year because it's because it's so delicious and it's so healthy. And, you know, I dug my garlic in early July, and, you know, I throw it in a pan with a little extra virgin olive oil and some sweet onions, and I chop up three different varieties of summer squash, and I have it with eggs for breakfast, and I have it with a piece of fish at dinner. And, you know, I can even eat it raw, and I don't need to put anything on it. So I think the key is to harvest it when it's young enough that the seeds are not overdeveloped so that it's tender and delicious. And you can eat it in so many different ways. And put a stand out on the sidewalk and with a jar and just put a price on it and do an honor system. I think you'll be surprised how your neighbors may support you, and
yeah,
you can buy your seeds for next year.
Yeah. Joe, good luck.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Amy, you want anything to say about that?
Well, I totally endorse what Stephen said, and I, you know, there's so many things you can do with summer squash. Put them in salads and, you know, breads and so forth and so on. And then when you get really tired of the glut and you're growing them in your own garden, well, you can harvest the blossoms for stuffing and sautéing and, you know, so much more. And then if you just want to leave them on the vine to maturity, the old-fashioned summer crookneck squash, when grown to maturity, becomes sort of razzle-dazzle orange and beautiful ornamental gourd that, you know, and you can even eat the seeds.
Hmm.
They're delicious and nutritious.
Yeah. Well, Amy Goldman is with us, a gardener and writer and all kinds of things. She's the author of The Heirloom Tomato and Melons for the Passionate Grower. She's with us, Stephen Rosenberg, owner of Liberty Heights Fresh, the market here in Salt Lake City. We'll get to more of your calls when we get back from a break. 801-585-WEST is that number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the fruits and the vegetables of summer, peaches and sweet corn and tomatoes, the joys of growing your own food and finding it. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Writer and gardener Amy Goldman with us, along with Stephen Rosenberg, the owner of Liberty Heights Fresh, the market here in Salt Lake City. And let's go back to the phones. Julie is with us in Salt Lake City. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Doug, and hi, Steve. It's Julie Peck-Dabbling with Salt Lake County's Urban Farming Program.
Hey, Julie.
Hey, and I love your idea of a stand. I'm going to have my son selling our extra tomatoes out on the driveway.
Yeah, everyone does Kool-Aid.
What a great idea.
I grew up on a country road, and we had a five-acre apricot orchard behind the house, and we had maybe 12 cars a day that would go up and down the road. And we would sit out there as six, seven, eight-year-old kids selling apricots by the quart.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a wonderful idea. He'll love to do that. Well, I was just going to say that I moved from Park City to Salt Lake in 1999, and we moved onto a half an acre in Holiday that had an apple tree, a plum tree, an apricot tree, and grapevines. And I couldn't stand to see that food wasted. So I started canning for the first time at the age of 40. And now I have a garden. I grow tomatoes and cucumbers that I have here at work today that are going to be part of my sandwich. I've grown broccoli and peppers and even melons. And what I can't grow, I love to go buy at the farmer's market. And it's just such a wonderful thing we have here in Utah. As for peaches, I prefer to eat them over the sink because they're just so juicy that way I can contain the mess. Yeah. And it's wonderful.
Yeah, good. Julie, thanks.
Yeah, thanks.
Well, she mentioned tomatoes. I wanted to, Amy Goldman, get you on the question of tomatoes. You've been growing vegetables for most of your life, but you say that the tomato, you describe it as the apple of your eye.
It definitely is. You know, tomatoes are incredibly diverse and beautiful and versatile in cookery. And I don't think, you know, apart from the apple or the peach, you know, for tree crops, there's no other garden-grown fruit, and it is a fruit. Tomatoes are fruits, technically, botanically, that's, you know, more popular across America, and for good reason.
Hmm. What are you looking for in a tomato? Is it sweetness? Is it texture? Again, is it that complexity in the flavor?
Well, the tomatoes with the most excellent flavor are high in acid and high in sugar. And I rate all my tomatoes, you know, on a flavor scale. And so from poor to excellent. But, you know, the ones that are the very best of all, my favorites also have other, you know, aroma and flavor compounds. The tomatoes that are grown on the vine and ripened in full sun are unrivaled. And, of course, the heirloom tomatoes are the best of all. I trialed over 1,000 different varieties of tomatoes over the course of 5 summers, so I could find 200 of the most delicious, beautiful, historic, unusual tomatoes in the world to feature in my tomato book. And many of them are family heirlooms bred by farmers and gardeners passed down within families and, you know, come with very colorful stories. And, you know, I think there are a lot of people out there who think that heirloom tomatoes are just for foodies, but that's just not so.
Hmm.
The heirloom tomato is the people's tomato, you know, bred by amateurs for the most part. And, you know, they're Gertie's tomatoes, Ben's, Sarah's, and so forth. And they're so easy to grow for most people, and even, you know, for the novice. It's a great place to start.
You know, we were talking earlier, the previous call, Julie, referenced the idea of preserving as well. And Stephen, you've talked about the fact that you've got a red sauce. Is it your grandmother's?
It's my wife's grandmother. Filoso was the family name, and they came to New York, and then she met my wife's grandfather while he was there studying, and they moved back here. But there's a tradition in the family of you know, making tomato sauce or making or preserving a really good variety of Roma style tomato. And the, you know, and what we do every, you know, it's a ritual for Aaron and I to get a couple of half bushel of these tomatoes, and we blanch them and we toss them in cold water, we peel them and we bag them in Ziploc bags, and then all winter we have, you know, fresh tomato sauce.
Yeah,
and it's so different than from a can.
Well, I want to do two practical things before we. Amy, give us a sense of. We don't have a lot of time left. Steve, you take on the peach. Amy, you take on the melon. Give us it, because it's more than just thumping, right? How do you pick a good one?
Okay, if you're talking about, you know, melons versus watermelons, what, you know, there are certain signs that you can use. A melon whose form is regular and normal, those are that are rounded and more symmetrical, are generally better. You want to look for color change. Those are, you know, that are on the yellower side, and I'm not talking about winter melons either. Those are a little different. You look for one that has, you know, the ground spot is lighter in color. You're looking for something that, you know, using your thumbs at the blossom end, it's a little soft, and so forth. Let's see. You don't want to get, you want a melon that's weighty for its size, but you don't want a super duper big one, because those have been fed too much fertilizer and water. And of course, you want to avoid those melons that look, you know, faded out, you know, or have any defects.
Yeah.
For watermelons, you know, it's much more difficult, but you generally want one that is weighty for its size. Where the ground spot or the couche on the belly of the beast is cream or yellow, where the rind is dull rather than shiny. And so, I mean, it's basically for watermelons, it's the eyeball test for form, weight, volume, and color.
Great. We don't have a lot of time, Stephen. Do peaches.
Well, I would only add to that, Amy, to that, that to use your nose, because a summer melon is going to be fragrant and it's going to be beautiful, and
absolutely,
you just can't miss it when it's ready. In terms of a ripened peach, I encourage people to – you're tempted to use your fingers to squeeze, but that maybe might work in a supermarket. It doesn't work in a peach orchard or peaches that are tree ripened. You want to use the very center of the palm of your hand. And you want a fully developed suture, the crease on the peach. The fruit needs to be round, more like a softball or a baseball. If it's still oblong or egg-shaped, it's not mature, and it's not going to taste good.
Stephen Rosenberg, Amy Goldman, thank you both very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. I'm Doug Fabrizio.